They're the same sort of Feynman diagrams are used in particle physics and in statistical physics. If you take something like the propagator for photons or phonons, which is called, as you know, D of Q, this is the Fourier transform of a D of RT, R prime, T prime, which, as you know, describes the correlation between operators that have something to do with phonons or photons properly time-ordered and properly averaged. This equation, with perhaps without that plus sign, are equally good equations for statistical physics and for field theory. The next step, as I needn't tell you, is to notice that D obeys the wave equation. Well, zero is what should appear on the right-hand side, except that, as was explained 5 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, you get a space-time delta function because of the rearrangement connected with the plus sign. Are we all on the same page? Because this isn't this is stuff I've prepared, and I only caught what I caught from. Okay. Now, everybody knows that it is not sufficient to write down a differential equation. That in addition to the differential equation, you need boundary conditions. Or maybe, depending on whether the equation is elliptic or hyperbolic, you need either boundary conditions or initial conditions. You were told what the boundary conditions people use in quantum field theory is. They were on the blackboard. I it is silly enough to erase them, but I put them on the blackboard. You have this scattering process, and you talk about T going to plus infinity and to minus infinity. I won't describe in detail how one arrives at that, but there is a good book on the subject. Well, not such a good book, but a book called Quantum Statistical Mechanics. Published by W.A. Benjamin and many other people with authors whom I know. That describes what I'm going to tell you about here. The original invention of what I'm talking about here was due to Matsubara, a Japanese Schwinger and Martin. I talked about Schwinger last time. Martin was one of my thesis advisors. So you have a boundary condition or initial condition related to the initial condition, in this case, related to these facts. And this will tell you about what the S matrix does. In statistical mechanics, what we have is that this guy is, when you write the expectation value, this is the trace sum over diagonal sum over all quantum mechanical states of e to the minus beta h. Or if you have some, you might want mu n, which is something one often does for systems where the number of particles changes. However, if one is dealing with photons, there's no such thing as a conserved n, and the mu n doesn't go in. So this is the trace of e to the minus beta h minus mu n times the thing you're talking about divided by the partition function. Now comes the insight. H is the time development operator. E to the minus beta H describes the time development through a time equal to beta. Or since beta isn't dimensionally a time, you got to stick an H bar in someplace, and H bars are too hard for me in the morning. So I will just tell you, you have to stick an H bar in someplace. So this describes time development. Through a time t is equal to, well, there's an I in the usual quantum mechanics. And certainly the sign of I is too hard for me. T is e to the minus I beta. Beta is 1 over an energy. H bar divided by an energy is a time. So this is a time development describing a motion through a time e to the I beta H bar. And the boundary condition, or initial condition, that goes with this is that this, after you play with the trace, you can prove that this d of rt r prime t prime minus I beta times h bar is equal to d of rt r prime t prime. That is, you can prove that you have this thing being periodic in this time interval. And that gives you an initial condition, which is used for stat mech. In particle physics, one is interested in the ground state. One is interested in the lowest energy state. One projects onto that lowest energy state by taking a beta. Beta is 1 over t to infinity. By nastiness of limits, this process of periodicity in IT goes over into this stuff, or in which you, is the equation still on the blackboard? I lost it someplace. Or in which one puts in I epsilons in the path. It's lost. Okay. But you remember that in the last lecture on the blackboard was a picture of a path of integration. This was not a picture of path of integration in time. I believe it was a path of integration in energy. But maybe it was time. I don't know. But in any case, it was a picture of a path of integration in which you stuck below the real axis for energy, I believe. You can tell me. You've got notes. What was it? OK, what was the path of integration in? Energy. You stuck below the real axis, or I have it backwards. You stuck above the real axis for a bit, and then you went below the real axis. This was a representation. This path of integration in energy is a representation of the time boundary conditions, minus infinity to infinity. There is a similar kind of thing that happens in this case. It is most easily described in position space. You could write the basic equations either in position space or in momentum space. And in position space, what you're doing is integrations over time between 0 and minus I beta. That means in order to do statistical mechanics, you have to do some analytic continuations in time. But analytic continuations are not so hard to do. And then one makes the full contact between quantum statistical mechanics and standard field theory. So I answered your question, I think. Okay, that I was also asked last time, and I'm going to spend a few more minutes on that, to talk a little bit about the history of physics. I'm afraid my version of the history of physics is a little bit like People magazine, but we're here for fun as well as being here for learning, and I'll give you a little bit of that. This time it's slightly more personal than last time. When we left the story, I was a postdoc in Copenhagen at the Bohr Institute for Theoretical Physics, having not understood anything that Bohr said to me. In fact, Gordon Baim was a postdoc there at the same time. We were both students together in graduate school at Harvard at the same time, but in the usual Harvard fashion, we were unaware of each other's existence, didn't talk to one another, and only met sort of in Copenhagen. Harvard is sort of like that. In Copenhagen, we took the work of our respective advisors, Paul Martin for myself, Gordon had Schwinger as the advisor, and wrote down things that were, to some extent, their ideas, but to some extent was an extension of their ideas. And it appeared in that book in 1962 or 63. This gives me a chance to boast. Something absolutely wonderful happened to me this year. The book was republished in Japanese. Now, it's authors don't much get the chance of having their books in print after 50 years. But it was better than being just in print. In print is good, but it was pirated. They're not paying me a penny of royalties. Some guy is trying to make money out of it illegally. That's a wonderful thing to happen. So I'm real proud, and I'm real proud to be able to tell you about it. Okay. Never really applied for a job. People sort of offered me jobs. And I was offered a job in Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois, which was in those days and is now a grand center, particularly for solid state physics, condensed matter physics, statistical physics. The senior professor at the University of Illinois, although there were two people substantially senior to me in my field, I was taking over Bob Schrieffer's job. Bob Schrieffer had been offered he was first a graduate student and then an assistant professor in Urbana. He had gotten offered a professorship at the University of Pennsylvania and was leaving. The other guy who was senior to me who was leaving for a period was David Pines. They each left behind what they described to me as an experienced graduate student. These experienced graduate students became my responsibility. I was amused to discover that these experienced graduate students were considerably older than I was. And they were experienced in the sense that they had respectively spent 10 and 11 years at graduate school at the University of Illinois. Well, it was sort of my job, I guess, to get these guys out the door. And I made my reputation at Illinois, not necessarily by doing physics, but getting each of them PhDs within a couple of years and having them find decent jobs. After that, I was walking on water as far as my colleagues were concerned. I could do no wrong. The big shot colleague was John Bardeen. John had worked at Bell Telephone Labs, in which he had participated in the group Bardeen, Bratton, and Shockley, which had invented the transistor. This is the key step, as almost all of you know, in the creation of the electronics age, each one of you, I suspect, or 90% of you, has one of those, and those things are inconceivable if done with vacuum tubes. You probably have never seen a vacuum tube, but it would make, if you tried to build this out of vacuum tubes, which is a pre-transistor technology, you would sort of need a trunk to carry it around. Okay. In any case, John had done something which was absolutely magnificent for technology. Bell Telephone Labs had mistreated him because they wanted him to continue to work on technological things, and he wanted to work on superconductivity. He picked up and left and went to the University of Illinois. Now, John is a person, was a person, unlike other people. His mind simply did not work the same way as other people did. He was very silent, very, very quiet, and very, very deep. And you'd go into his office and ask him a question, and nothing much would happen. Well, after a while, you learned what to do. You produced a simple question for John, and then you waited for an answer. You have to phrase the question correctly. My wife at that time asked John, for example, at a dinner party, whether he had had a nice summer. There was a long pause, and the reply was, yes. But if you asked the right kind of question, a more informative answer would come back in about 2 minutes. So you had to stand there for 2 minutes waiting for the brain to go through all the possibilities, understand the deep issues involved, and produce an answer. Then you were supposed to go away for a week or 2 weeks, figure out what the answer meant, and phrase another question, and come back again and go through that cycle once more. John's wife said that all kinds of people missed all kinds of wonderful things that could have come out of John by just not standing around long enough waiting for the answer to their question. At Urbana, I spent some time talking about this stuff. This book has in it a relationship between what you learned in field theory and some of the traditional things in statistical mechanics. In particular, it has the derivation of Boltzmann equations, Boltzmann-like equations, or Boltzmann equations, from the quantum field theory. The derivation is not real hard. In fact, it's a place that I should make contact again with what you did in the last lecture. In the last lecture, you have an energy denominator, EP plus EP prime minus EQ minus EQ prime, or something like that. The energy denominator, there were actually three energies in the final state, because there were three particles in the final state, at least in one of those things. This is what you have when you're calculating an energy shift. If you calculate a process, or when you calculate an amplitude. If you're calculating a squared amplitude, roughly the same thing comes in, except that instead of having one over it, you have a delta function. That is, roughly speaking, what Dohen does is take the imaginary part of that, do what's done up there, and you get out the delta functions that Boltzmann put into his equation from the energy denominators that are natural for quantum mechanics. I talked about this stuff at Urbana and had the honor and ego gratification of having John come and listen to my lectures about this. So nice. Okay, so I've now done history and tried to make contact as requested between the different subjects that we are studying, or you are studying, or I'm studying too. We are studying here at the Perimeter Institute. Further questions? I'm going to go back to mean field theory. Mean field theory. The basic equation is that the average magnetization at point R in mean field theory is the hyperbolic tangent of the magnetic field at R. I had a J in last time, but J is just a represents the position, and it is more physical to talk about the position as a position vector in space, plus a coupling constant times the sum over S nearest neighbor to R, S being a position vector on a nearest neighbor site, of sigma S. We had analyzed this for a small coupling, weak magnetic field, and we found that as T went to zero, T went to infinity, small coupling, weak magnetic field, we got more or less sigma, and no spatial dependence, so I erased the R, is H divided by 1 minus K times the number of nearest neighbors time. That's the answer. We looked at T goes to infinity and found that we looked at T goes to zero and found that the magnetization pointed in one of two directions and that we could analyze that also. Now we're looking at the combined limit, sigma being small, H being small, K, Z being approximately equal to 1. This is the place in which the system first starts to magnetize and has interesting results. The phenomenological results, which I haven't written down for you, is that as a function of temperature at magnetic field equal to zero, at low temperatures, one has a magnetization which is large. It could be large and negative, but large. And then it goes down at some critical temperature. At high temperatures, it is exactly zero. By running around the building following the suggestion or example of one of the members of this class, I found something valuable to me, colored chalk. Apparently, colored chalk is provided for research, but not for teaching. Not that I have a political message here, but I left, there's only a little chalk out there because I left some for research. Okay, we're going to be interested in this region. We're going to be interested in this region for several reasons. The most interesting reason is that this is something that we could not expect to happen. I will talk about this a lot. But if you calculate what the what e to the minus beta h, the sum over all states of magnetization at R divided by Z, which is that thing, then you discover that in any finite system, this thing is the sum of a finite number of exponentials, and that means that because it's the sum of a finite number of exponentials, and because the coefficients are positive, this is analytic. That is, well, you know what analytic means. Infinitely differentiable, arbitrarily smooth, continuable in all directions, in everything, including k and h. That's not analyticity. That has a zero, has an infinite first derivative in t, with t being just a fancy way of writing 1 over k. And that is some difficulty that we must face. I'll tell you more about that. There's going to be a lot more about that. In any case, this non-analyticity arises in the neighborhood that I described here. And it would be fun to analyze the mean field theory in that neighborhood. We may learn something about the non-analyticity by looking at a case in which there's a little bit of magnetization. We might understand something about how the system produces its average magnetization. And this is an interesting subject of study. So I'm going to take the case, first I'm going to be working in which things are independent of R, and then I'm going to look at the R dependence. And we write down, I better get my notes. The result of an expansion of the hyperbolic tangent in small things. HR plus the sum over S nearest neighbor to R, K times the average value of sigma sub S. And then there is a term minus 1/3 this thing cubed. This thing cubed. I'm going to butcher this thing cubed by throwing away the h cubed term. It's not going to be important to me. Throwing away this s dependence, saying that all of the sigmas are at r, and then I will get k times z. That's the number of nearest neighbors times sigma r all cubed. This is an appropriate thing to do in this limit. This term is a small correction to these terms, and we're handling it with a lower order of accuracy. In fact, we're going to go one step further. The critical point is kz equals 1. And so I will set kz equal to 1 here, but not there. Further analysis. I will then drop the R dependence. I will call this expectation value of sigma. Hold on to the R dependence. One more step. I'm adding and subtracting a sigma r here. The reason for subtracting the sigma r is that I want to know what the position dependence here is. So I'm subtracting that, and I will add on kz sigma r. You will recognize that I have done nothing at all. There are z terms in the summation. This and this are the same thing. This minus sign makes sure that that cancels. And then minus 1/3 sigma r cubed.
Question.
Yes, please.
Did you add an extra k on the sum term?
I sure did add an extra k. K's are nice, but we can't have more than them below. Thank you. Okay, ready to start the analysis. I will talk about a situation in which we have no space dependence. Left-hand side, sigma. Right-hand side, h. Right-hand side, this term is zero. That's why I fixed it up that way. Plus k times z times sigma r minus, I'm supposed to have no r, minus 1/3 sigma cubed. Kz, or k as you recall, is a coupling divided by Boltzmann constant times temperature. Kz can be written as 1 minus Tc over T minus plus Tc over T minus 1. Now let's get that right. At low T over T. Nope, that's right. So Kz is approximately equal to 1 in our analysis, and we will write the correction, since it's linear in 1 over t, we'll write the correction as Tc over t minus 1. This Tc will be the critical temperature, and when t equals Tc, exciting things are about to happen. The ones cancel, and we end up with an equation that sigma r times Tc over t minus 1. No r, bless you. Is equal to h plus 1/3 sigma cubed. Time for my notes. I'm not going to be happy with signs if I get them wrong. Minus. If T is bigger than Tc, this is a negative quantity. T is smaller than T. Get the signs right, excuse me. On the right-hand side of the equation, I had Kz, which was 1 plus T over Tc over T minus 1. On the right-hand side of the equation, I had Tc over T minus 1. Well, that's right. Okay, fine. Signs are correct now. We'll be in a moment looking at the physics, and the physics will tell us a lot about the signs, so it's easy not to make a mistake. I want to talk first about the magnetization at H equals zero. Sigma times Tc over T minus 1 minus 1/3 sigma cubed is equal to zero. One obvious solution is sigma equals zero. The other obvious solutions, cancel out the factor of sigma from this equation, you get sigma squared is equal to 3 Tc over T minus 1, or you get sigma is equal to plus or minus this thing to the 1/2 power. Well, this is appropriate for low temperatures, for T less than Tc. You're not going to have a pure imaginary solution. It is a pure imaginary solution for higher temperatures, but that's exactly what we wanted, exactly what we expected. We have a picture that looks like that. At low temperatures, this solution matters. At high temperatures, it's only this solution that matters. And if we go back to Maxwell's thinking about it, we will recognize that what we have to do is calculate the stability of the different solutions. This one has a lower free energy than this one has a lower free energy than this one at temperatures less than the critical temperature. This is the only thing that's possible at temperatures above the critical temperature. So let me write that down. Wins for T less than TC, wins for T greater than TC. That's, oh, life is hard. We want to put a square root right there. Thank you. Is that the square root I'm missing? So I noticed that people later on talked about things like the magnetization depending on the temperature minus the critical temperature. Since we're working and we're doing equilibrium, I can use small t to describe t minus tc over tc. I can use small t to describe that. And people say that you have sigma is proportional to minus t to the power beta. This defines a power beta, and people have measured the value of beta. Going back to the time of van der Waals. In van der Waals' day, a scientist, Dutch scientist, whose name I can't pronounce and don't remember, measured beta. And van der Waals was aware of Andrew's work, and Andrew's work was sufficient to measure a rough value of beta. And they found beta equals 1/3. As the experimental value. Beta equals 1/2 is the mean field theory value, and we're going to have to struggle with that discrepancy for a time. But so far, what we can say is that mean field theory has given us a qualitative understanding of what we see in that picture and enables us to give a kind of pretty decent qualitative view of what goes on in a phase transition. I can do more analysis. I can talk about the susceptibility, d sigma dh, which is called the magnetic susceptibility, and is given the symbol chi. That's not an x, that's a c, that's a chi. A chi. D sigma dh, and we actually calculated it last time. It's on the board someplace, and we found that it is of the form 1 over k 1 minus kz, which is then 1 over the temperature minus the critical temperature for T greater than 0. And for T less than 0, which we have to take into account this term, and I won't bother doing that, I will just say that we get an answer which is proportional to 1 over the magnitude of T. For T less than 0, T less than 0 as well. And so that we have a index, which is called gamma, to go here, and that in mean field theory, a gamma equals 1. Every people who did measurements of properties of magnets found a variety of values of gamma, but among the values they found was 4/3, which came up fairly often. The analogous quantity in a fluid is the compressibility, the derivative of the order parameter, which is rho minus rho c, or rho, with respect to to the pressure. And there is certainly a measurement giving gamma equals 4/3, dating back again almost to the time of Andrews in 1870. And certainly by the time, by 1900, this value of gamma was known. Now we're going to make a lot of this discrepancy between the values that you get out of mean field theory, which was the only existing theory, and the values you get from experiment. However, the choice of what to study is a hard choice. And in the years just after 1900, the leadership of this kind of physics was a man by the name of Kamerle Onnes. Kamerle Onnes was building a laboratory at Leiden in which gases were liquefied and low temperature physics was studied. This laboratory, for example, was the place where superconductivity was discovered. Kamerle Onnes has said more or less that this discrepancy between this and that was an amusing toy, but serious people will not pay much attention to it. We shouldn't worry. I mean, field theory is kind of inaccurate anyhow. Let's do serious things like measuring the properties of helium. So this discrepancy was swept under the rug. We'll come back to it. Okay, fellow, which one do we get here? We should get the middle one. Other interesting things were known about the behavior near the phase transition. A phenomenon called critical opalescence. Critical opalescence. In part, I abbreviate because I can't spell it. In part, I abbreviate because I'm lazy. What was known, this phenomenon is you take a pot of fluid. You look at it when it's a gas, you look at it when it's a liquid, and you can see through it. Then you move it close to criticality. That is close to the critical pressure and the critical temperature, and all of a sudden it goes cloudy. What is happening is the drops of the wrong phase are formed. These drops of the wrong phase, that is, if you have a gas, drops of liquid appear. If you have a liquid, pockets of vapor appear. So drops of the wrong phase appear. Those drops scatter light effectively, and there, what you see is a cloudy fluid. For them to scatter effectively, according to the law of scattering studied by Rayleigh, according to the Rayleigh scattering theory, you had to have relatively big drops, drops comparable in size to the wavelength of light, since the wavelength of light is 5,000 angstroms and the size of an atom is about an angstrom. What you're seeing is drops that are 5,000 times bigger than you might have expected on the basis of the idea that the drops should form at about the same size as the radius of the interactions between forces. Einstein picked up on the idea that critical opalescence was important. At the same time, so did a Polish scientist by the name of Smoluchowski. Approximate spelling. They said more or less that this cloudiness was an indication that the system was able to expand and contract locally. And they more or less said that you should look at the susceptibility, which in the fluid case was the derivative of the density minus the critical density. Density here meaning not a probability density, but density being the number of particles per unit volume. Look at the derivative of the density minus the critical density with respect to pressure, which, as I said last time, had an analog in the magnetic system as the derivative of the magnetization with respect to field. Now, I already told you what sort of thing was going to happen. That derivative, which is up there on the board someplace, was going to go to infinity at criticality. The system gets all easy to compress. That's the fluid. The magnet is trying to figure out what direction it wants to point its magnetization in. It makes, as you saw in the computer simulation, large regions in which the magnetization points in one direction, and then other large regions in which the magnetization points in the other direction. And that's what happens near the critical point. So Einstein and Smoluchowski said that the explanation for this critical opalescence effect was the divergence of these thermodynamic derivatives. I just explained to you up there the thermodynamic derivatives don't diverge in statistical mechanics, because everything is analytic in everything. But nonetheless, we have a fact, and facts are hard to argue with. Einstein then calculated stuff that had to do with this and used it to estimate the number, Avogadro's number. Einstein's work in this 1905 period had several very important elements, but one of the pieces of work that he was doing in this era was figuring out four or five different ways of estimating Avogadro's number, and thereby proving to even the most skeptical of critics that the atomic theory was right. The very most skeptical of the critics was Mach, who said there are no atoms, or that you shouldn't assume that there are no atoms because we haven't seen them. Einstein destroyed Mach's point of view. That's sort of funny because later on, Einstein derived general relativity by using some of Mach's ideas about the philosophy of science. But consistency is not what we might expect in science, or only at the consistency is something we expect in the long run. But in the short run, we have to live with inconsistencies. But I want to do a calculation which says something about the big drops and says something about this divergence susceptibility. You remember that sigma at R is the derivative with respect to magnetic field at R of the logarithm of the partition function. You also remember that sigma at R minus expectation value of sigma at R times sigma at S minus the expectation value of sigma at S is the second derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to H at R and H at S. We are going to calculate that second derivative in mean field theory by using the equation that I have right up there. That calculation will then tell us about this correlation function, which goes under the quaint name of G of R minus S. If we evaluate this at magnetic field equal to zero, that is, first you calculate the derivatives, then you set the magnetic field equal to zero. This thing is a function of R minus S. H equals zero implies a translationally invariant system. And if I had had enough, this fact that the symbol used in the last lecture for the Green's function is G, used D also, but G was used as a symbol for the Green's function. And this fact that this is called G is not an accident. These are the same blessed things. The Green's function was defined as the correlated fluctuations in the important field variable in the ground state of the system. That's what G was, except for that plus sign, which talked about time ordering. And that's what this G is. It is the correlations among the fluctuations in the important variable in the system. Question. One of the sigma S's should and one shouldn't. Thank you. Thank you. I can't. Break. Two more minutes of history. Something that I knew, but you all might not have known. John Bardeen was dissatisfied with his work on the transistor. That was in part because his bosses at Bell Labs were not very nice people. And that was in part because he felt it wasn't reflection of the best work he could do in science. So one of the things that he wanted to do was to go to to do work which was reflective of the best stuff he could do. And the behavior of superconductivity was something that had been left ununderstood since Camerly-Onis had discovered it in 1911. John came to the University of Illinois, and together with a postdoc by the name of Leon Cooper and his graduate student, Bob Schrieffer, already mentioned, figured out the BCS theory of superconductivity. A bunch of years later, while I was still at Urbana, these guys got the Nobel Prize for the BCS theory of superconductivity. Bardeen had won a previous Nobel Prize for the transistor, but he felt it was sort of slightly unworthy of him, but he was more or less satisfied with this Nobel Prize, I think. There is a history going with Nobel Prizes. You're supposed to joke about them to some extent. Feynman sent Bardeen a note in which he offered to give Bardeen his list of telephone numbers in Stockholm, telephone numbers being clearly telephone numbers of sex objects, which were much more used to Feynman in his lifestyle than to Bardeen in his lifestyle, so that was more or less a joke. Bardeen was an avid golf player, and golf has a tradition in which you win a wonderful piece of silver for if you win a tournament, and you put it on your mantelpiece, and you give it back the next year to the committee who gives it to the next guy who wins. However, if you win three times, you get to keep the thing, and the committee has to go build another one. So with following the tradition, I sent Bardeen a telegram saying, congratulations, keep up the good work. Third time around, and you get to keep the queen. In any case, let's do some calculations. Okay. So we have sigma r is hr plus Let's go to the equation and get it right. I've got the right equation up there. Right here. One minus K is Z times sigma R is HR plus K times the sum over S nearest neighbor to R. Sigma S minus sigma R minus 1/3 sigma R cubed. I will set this K equal to 1 over Z since I'm right near the critical point. I will call this thing minus T, T being the temperature deviation from criticality. So here I have minus T times sigma R. And then I do a little calculation. That little calculation is, what does it mean to have sigma S minus sigma R here if we're summing over all of the S's which are nearest neighbors to R? And what we do is an expansion in which sigma S is sigma R plus S minus R times the gradient with respect to R of sigma R. I'm assuming small variation, slow variation in space and time, and S is close by. And then the next term is plus 1/2 S minus R, two dots, two derivatives, sigma R, plus dot, 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 and I don't include any more. In the summation process there, this cancels against this. Because at the nearest neighbor vectors point in all possible directions, this term cancels out. This term requires that we have components of S minus R that point in the same direction, and this then gives us A squared when they point in the same direction, A being the distance between lattice sites. And this thing is del squared. And we end up, when we calculate the result, we end up with 1 minus kz is sigma r plus 1 minus kz times sigma r is the magnetic field. And assuming slow variation in space, we get 1 over z del squared times a squared times sigma r. And I'm going to be working in a situation of small magnetization, and I'm going to not include that term. And now I'm about to differentiate with respect to S. 1 minus kz, that's called minus t. Times the derivative of sigma r with respect to hs is the delta symbol that requires r to be equal to s plus earth did that one-third come from? That's a bad one-third. A squared, no, it doesn't belong. Oh, no, k over, this is 1 over z. It's not one-third, except when we're in three dimensions, it's, no, in three dimensions, it's 6. Okay, this is 1 over z. Thank you. Here?
In sigma s equal.
This delta function. This, we got a problem here. Let me tell you about the problem. I'm going to do half a continuum analysis and half a discrete analysis. What you're asking me to say is that delta r minus s, I haven't yet made the mistake, but I was going to make the mistake of writing this as the delta function of r minus s. So you're ahead of me. I will then fix up the mistake by putting in an a cubed there, or an a to the dimension of the system. At least it's dimensionally correct, and in fact, it's the right thing to do.
Asking about previous line, sigma s average equal to the expansion in upper the third
here.
Line.
Here.
This line here.
Okay.
And first order term.
First order term, here. If there, the first order term has an a in it, okay. A times a unit vector in the direction of the s minus r is A times a unit vector I, j, k. I'll call this unit vector L since it's not going to be either I or j or k, but it's going to be another unit vector.
I just can't understand why we put A in second order and don't put first order.
A in second order comes from this S minus R factor. Here we threw the term out before we had a chance to put in what belongs here, which is A times L. So I would do what you asked me to, except I threw away the term earlier. So before I got to write A times L, I crossed it out. Yes?
Sorry, could you repeat why you throw away the gradient?
I'm about to do something. In fact, this is the same thing that was bothering this gentleman. S minus R is A times L. L takes on, in two dimensions, four values. I, unit vector pointing in the x direction, minus I, unit vector pointing in the minus x direction, j, minus j. And in three dimensions, we would have a k minus k. These six values or four values are the values taken on by L. Will you accept that much? And what we're doing is we have, aha, that's what I didn't do. We have the sum over S's, which are nearest neighbor to R. So leaving out the writing the sum, I was making a terrible mistake. And you guys caught me on the mistake. Sum, S nearest neighbor to R. So I'm summing over these four or six cases. And when I do the summation, I get cancellation between this and this, between that and that, between that and that. And so I cross the thing off. No, I don't. Let me explain why. I surely get a 1/2 from this term. I then get the same 1/2 from this term, and 1/2 and 1/2 is 1. I then get two or three terms, depending on whether I'm working in two or three dimensions. I get a sum of stuff, and that gives me the del squared. So remarkably and surprisingly enough, I've got the right answer here. However, I had to, with your help, put in this summation and this summation, and then explain what the summation was about in order to get the right answer. So now we have an equation in which g of r minus s is 1 over z times del squared of g of, I was just busy calculating. Sorry, I got stuck at this stage. You guys didn't let me go on. Is a squared divided by z, the number of nearest neighbors, times del squared of g of r and s. I would then make this replacement and go into a continuum theory. The derivative of sigma r with respect to hs is g of r minus s. I then take it, so let me rewrite the equation. I've done this a little sloppily. This equation then becomes minus t times g of r minus s is equal to a to the dimension of the system times the delta function of r minus s. When I replace the delta symbol by this, it was an indication I was going to think about the continuum, plus 1 over z, z being the number of nearest neighbors, times the distance between nearest neighbors squared, times del squared of g of r minus s. Fourier transform, that is, multiply by e to the I k dot r minus s and integrate over r or s, and you get minus t times g of k. Depends on the magnitude of k only, as we will see in a moment. I've now gone into momentum spaces one does in field theory. Yes?
I didn't follow why you get g of r minus s on the right-hand side.
Okay, I did that sloppily, so I will go to it right the next time through. You guys just don't let me be sloppy at all. Okay, I'm differentiating this equation with respect to hs. Let me erase what I did and then tell you what I should have done. I take the derivative then of this term with respect to hs. That derivative operation commutes with the del squared, and I end up with del squared a squared times delta sigma at r with respect to hs. And then if I included the terms that I just left out with a minus sign, I would get plus 3/3, because it's a cube. I would then get sigma r squared times the derivative of sigma r with respect to hs. And I'm going to argue that sigma r is small, because I'm at temperatures above the critical temperature at zero magnetic field, and I'm about to get rid of this term. This term is the Green's function. This term is the Green's function. I then get an equation for the Green's function, which is written. Here. Who was I answering? Am I now okay? So we Fourier transform this equation. We get minus t times g of k. And continuing the song and dance that I had at the beginning of the lecture, this is, in essence, the same thing as the Green's function you talked about in the last lecture. That's 1, the Fourier transform of the delta function, plus a squared over z. Del squared turns into minus k squared, g of k. I then solve for g of k. And I slipped a sign. I know what the sign should be, and it's wrong. This is a to the d. No, let's flip this sign. Plus k squared a squared over z. From this term, and here I got a sine rule because this should be a positive t. And I'm not going to go back and get that sign right. You all can redo the analysis and get it correct. This is an interesting result. I can undo the Fourier transform and get the result. First, you notice that this is a form of a propagator in field theory. Momentum squared plus or minus something or other. That something or other is the analog of the mass squared. So this is the analog of g is 1 over p squared plus m squared, or p squared minus m squared, depending on your convention for p squared. So this is a familiar result from field theory. If we calculate what that correlation function is by undoing the Fourier transform, which I'm about to do, then we get g of r minus s. So far, I have done the calculation in d dimensions. D could be 1, 2, 3, infinity, or 17, or 21.2. I now specialize to three dimensions because the inverse of the Fourier transform is easy in three dimensions. There is a factor, a numerical factor, which I remember to be 1 over 4 pi, but that numerical factor is unimportant from our purposes. There is a factor of the magnitude of r minus s. And then there is e to the minus, the familiar factor, r minus s, divided by the coherence length. And the coherence length is described by the pole in this Green's function. The coherence length is a divided by t to the 1/2. And then there is a factor of z. This is an interesting result. This result is due to Ornstein and Zernike. That's a space for a C, which may or may not be there. They worked in about 1910 and did essentially this calculation for a magnetic system. No, I'm sorry, for a fluid system. In fact, this calculation somewhat more sophisticated than this, somewhat more in the modern version. This is a simplification of their calculation. The important thing is that as you approach criticality, as t goes to 0, the range of correlations diverges. So this statement that we made about large drops is borne out by the correlation function, correlations between spins at two different places. There's a large drop of magnetization pointing in one direction here, maybe one direction or another direction there, and C represents the typical size of the drop. Brief pause. Te Hooft is a Dutch scientist who won a Nobel Prize for learning how to do gauge field theory in the perturbation expansion in a convergent, apparently convergent way, term by term. When I was talking about this stuff roughly in front of him, he pointed out, oh, Zernike, yes, I know him, knew him. He was my uncle, or granduncle, or something. Physics is a small world. Okay, so we discover that the range of correlations, as we more or less expected, sort of the typical size of a drop, goes to infinity. We discover that if you are within the typical size of a drop, you have a result which is independent of, which is always of the same form. You have what is called scale invariance for R minus S, much less than C. You have G being proportional to R minus S to a power. The power is conventionally written as D minus 2 plus eta. And this is the statement that in mean field theory, eta equals 0. The best modern values of eta are quite small for three dimensions. They are, in three dimensions, roughly 0.06. And so this is a place in which mean field theory is particularly good. Not perfect, but particularly good. So, in the first half of the 20th century, the qualitative properties of phase transitions had been established by a variety of scientists who had studied mean field theory of phase transitions and got all of the qualitative properties right. There was a, as one describes it in physics, a cloud no bigger than a man's hand on the horizon. That that comes from the Bible. You're about to get a storm. The cloud no bigger than a man's hand on the horizon in this analyticity question. But like Camille Onis, science had swept the analyticity question under the rug. In 1937, Landau put together, I'm going to go another 10 minutes. Landau put together a general theory of phase transitions. He said, let's talk about the logarithm of the partition function. Let's think that we have a large system and we get contributions from that large system. And those are contributions from the large system. Well, we want to work more or less in the area which you can expand as I expanded here. And so we're going to expand the logarithm of z in a result which is going to be of the form an expansion in sigma r. So there's a term A independent of sigma r. There's a term in which we have a hr sigma of r. I am now writing it as sigma of r. Since I'm thinking about the continuum, it is the same thing as sigma sub r, or more or less, or rather proportional to sigma sub r. We then get a factor b times sigma of r squared. So Landau is thinking of expanding the free energy, that's what you got here, in a series in sigma of r. Because of the symmetries of the system, you don't get a sigma of r cube term. You get a term in sigma of r to the fourth power. And then you get a term in del squared. I have an A and a B and a C. And I don't like D, so I'll put it in E. You have a term in gradient of sigma r all squared. And I better, if I want E to be positive, put in a minus sign here, because I don't want to have the possibility of very large gradients of magnetization squared, because if I have, if that gives me a, want a plus sign. I want to have, when you get a coefficient of minus sign, I want to have it unlikely that we could have large gradients of sigma of r, and I want to make sure that the signs in this equation are right, so that that large excursions are impossible. So I want c to be less than zero. That means if I have a very large sigma of r, I get a very small contribution to the system, and I want E to be greater than zero in this form of writing. Sigma of R, and this is sort of the key step, is the same thing as we talked about before, expectation value of sigma at R. Landau then said, I could sort of do this with any kind of phase transition problem. If it happens to be true that, if, for example, I have a fluid or a single axis ferromagnet, this sigma of r should be a scalar variable and everything is as written here. If we're working with vector magnetization, as you do in the Heisenberg model, in which the magnetization can point in any direction in three-dimensional space, we have a vector magnetic field and a vector magnetization, and this thing really means sigma of r dot sigma of r, in order that you get the proper invariance properties of the outcome. This thing means sigma of r dot sigma of r squared. And there's something obvious to be said about that, which I'm not going to say. Landau also analyzed the case in which there's a cubic term in this, and I'll tell you what happens in a moment. Landau then said that the system does something clever for itself. We're used to the idea that the partition function should be maximized by the correct thermodynamic state. That means the free energy should be minimized in the correct thermodynamic state. That means that we choose sigma of r so as to maximize the partition function. This assumes that sigma of r is a sort of macroscopic variable. It assumes that that we have slow enough variation in space so that you can handle sigma of r in macroscopic terms. But that's a pretty good assumption. What do you get from that? Well, I shouldn't erase this because this is more or less what you get from it. So let me find a blackboard someplace. There's a blackboard. How many of you have seen calculations with variational derivatives? Yes, 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 yes. Okay. So I'm demanding that the variational derivative with respect to sigma of r of the logarithm of z be equal to zero. That's what the extremal principle is. And that's where we follow up on Landau's view. You don't get anything from A. Where are we? We're hidden. No. I lost. We don't get anything from A. We get HR from that next term. we get 2b times sigma of r from the next term. We get c times 4 times sigma of r cubed from the next term. And we get from the term an e and an integration by parts del squared sigma of r. Well, this is beginning to look sort of familiar. If we take b being proportional to the deviation from criticality, this is exactly the equation we use for mean field theory. So in 1937, Landau said that all mean field theories are sort of alike, following up on Anna Karenina, and that they all can be described as variational stuff like this. Yes? Let's look and see what the convention is there. Minus sign. I have the gradient acting on sigma. I then, in order to get two gradients acting on sigma, have to do an integration by parts, and I have the correct sign. I have no guarantee that there's any correct, that I have the correct sign here. I blew a sign there early on, and I haven't recovered it. So Landau said that all mean field theories are the same, and that they are all described in these terms, and that everybody has beta equals 1/2 because of that. Again, Landau never said that exactly this, but that's a consequence of his ideas. They all have the coherence length going as 1 over c to the nu, and nu is 1/2, as in the calculation we did via Ornstein and Zernike, and so forth. One more thing should be said, and I guess I can quit. Landau and other people calculated then the behavior of the specific heat. Specific heat is the second derivative with respect to temperature or to K of the logarithm of the partition function. This, I guess the specific heat is the wrong term for it. The literal term is the heat capacity, the capacity of the system to absorb temperature. And there is a picture that goes with that, and I'm going to draw the picture. Here is T, here is TC, here is the region below TC. Here is the heat capacity. And the heat capacity tends to go up in mean field theory calculations, and in Landau's calculation. It goes up and up, in part, goes up because the order parameter magnetization is more sensitive for T less than TC as the temperature goes up. Then the order parameter disappears, and you get a discontinuous jump in the specific heat, and then you get a continued rise. This is a picture which is typical of mean field theories, and it occurs within the Landau theory, in which one is focusing partially on this region. This jump at the critical temperature is a very characteristic feature of mean field theories. So in 1937, mean field theories had been put on a field theoretic footing. It has been said that all these systems were alike. And there was an elegant, lovely theory which described how they were all alike. Next time, I will tell you about a conference in Amsterdam, also in the year 1937, in which Kramers pointed out this analyticity thing that I talked to you about there, and in which the assembled statistical mechanics of the world was shocked to learn that the work with respect to the van der Waals theory that they knew well and the Landau theory, which they hadn't yet absorbed, were both entirely and completely wrong. But that's for next time. So this time I'll answer questions.
Yeah, I was wondering, why do you, I mean, this is, didn't we, okay, I'm not getting the way, what we were doing, because we had a problem that we had a theory that was analytic and it couldn't describe the behavior around the critical point, and now we have a new theory that's also analytic, but does describe.
Okay, you want to push me to talk about what I'm going to talk about next time.
But
I will do it. I'm quite responsive. I will just say it twice, which is probably the right number of times to say it anyhow. Van der Waals' theory looks like so, more or less, or something like that. I have it flipped over. It's a cubic equation. It has a minimum and goes up on both sides. That's what van der Waals' theory looks like in a pressure 1 over the volume, probably, diagram. Perfectly analytic, however, perfectly without phase transitions. Maxwell fixes it up by doing a jump like that, which says that the density of the system jumps discontinuously. Maxwell is certainly right. The jump occurs. It is a proper thermodynamic effect, and in fact, Maxwell uses the condition that the entropy change be zero across the jump to say how the jump would occur in if you did it slowly, adiabatically is a technical term. However, there then gets to be a problem. This is the problem I will talk about next time, as is exposed in that 1937 conference. This Maxwell construction disagrees with the fundamental consequences of the statistical mechanics of finite systems, and that then leaves you with an intellectual problem. There's the problem from which we are going to start, which we will start sort of halfway through the next lecture, there's too little space on the margins of the blackboard for me to write down the solution to this little problem, and so I will leave it for next time. Further questions or comments? Yes, please.
Why do we choose the logarithm of a partition function like that?
Okay. There are This is an act of genius. I cannot tell you how acts of genius occur. But Landau more or less said that we have a system in which you add up things that occur over the entire volume of the system. Add up means integration. Logarithm of Z is the free energy and is extensive. So it is reasonable to think about adding up over the entire system. Now let me spend just a second thinking about maybe I can figure out a good case for doing this. Yes, I can. If I take a situation like the one I analyzed in detail today, in which the magnetization, magnetic field, and variation in space are all small, then it is reasonable to expand the free energy in terms of magnetization variation in space of the magnetization, and the parameters like magnetic field.
So why don't you reduce the sigma to the power 3?
Ah. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Excuse me, I forgot to tell you about that. So Landau, in detail, put in a d prime term times sigma of r to the power 3. When we did our analysis of this equation, we saw a clear indication of a second order. Ehrenfest called it, a second order phase transition. That is a diagram for the magnetization, which looks like that, which comes down to a value and then stops. And then there were first order phase transitions. That is the jump in the magnetization that I don't have on the board, but is the jump, for example, between the vapor and the fluid state. This is what he saw with no sigma cube term. He also analyzed what he saw with a sigma cube term. And this, with a sigma cube term, he got only a first order phase transition, no second order phase transition. And so let me put that on the board. I get a little board to do that. So Landau said the world is divided into two kinds of systems, systems which have a sufficient symmetry to have a second order phase transition, like a fluid or a magnet, and systems that don't have enough symmetry to do that. And we know such things, for example, in the present era, we understand that liquid crystals, or better yet, the solid gas transition is only first order, and is partially understood by saying that it has a sigma cube term, an order parameter cube term in the Landau theory expansion. There is a little difficulty because of the first part of my answer to your question. You never have a case in which the magnetization goes to zero. It looks like the best derivation of the Landau thing from first principles. We don't have that. We just have sort of hand waving. It looks like the Landau thing is best so there is something problematic about first order phase transitions within the Landau theory. That problematic thing we have to worry about a little bit, but the Landau theory gives a pretty good qualitative description of first order phase transitions. Now, there's another question which you haven't asked, which I want to answer. Why focus all this attention on details like the second order phase transition, which is only a tiny part of the phase diagram, or finicky mathematical details? Finicky is not a word most of you understand. Small mathematical details like the analyticity of the result. The answer is you follow up on things that look interesting, and maybe you learn things that are surprising. Analyticity is something that looks interesting. The first order phase transitions is something that looks interesting. It looks interesting to have a good field theory point of view on it. It's good. It's interesting to have a good field theory point of view on second order phase transitions. We will follow that where it leads, and that's for the next lecture. Lunchtime, guys.